Broadcasting from Manhattan Beach and the World Wide Web, you're listening to CHSR, HealthyLife.net.
As a service to our listeners, this program is for general information and entertainment purposes only. CHSRHealthyLife.net does not recommend, endorse, or object to the views, products, or topics expressed or discussed by show hosts or their guests. We suggest you always consult with your own personal, medical, financial, or legal advisor.
Welcome to Center Point. I'm your host, Dr. Ron Anbar. In this show, we will discuss ways that we can journey to our own centers. This can help us access our inner resources to improve our physical abilities and health, our mental strength, our emotional well-being, and our spirituality. Today, I have a very special guest introduced, Dr. David Godot. Hello, David.
Hello, Ron.
Thank you so much for joining us. David and I just came back from a conference. We had a chance to get to know each other pretty well, and I'm looking forward to learning even more about you today. Dr. Godot is a psychologist based out of Long Beach, California. He's the owner and clinical director of a psychotherapy group practice called Psych Lab Psychology Center, which is a training practice focused on collaborative learning and deliberate practice of relational psychotherapy with an emphasis on mindfulness, mentalization, and attachment repair. David's a past president of the American Psychological Association Division 30, which is the Society of Psychological Hypnosis. He's been involved with leadership and providing clinical training in hypnosis for 15 years. He also has a background in transpersonal psychology, esoteric philosophy, and Tibetan Buddhism, literature and performance poetry, as well as technology, computer science, and artificial intelligence. You have a tremendous background, David. Thank you so much for sharing it with us today.
Well, I'm looking forward to talking with you. I've had such a good time getting to know you at the SESH conference. And I imagine we'll have a lot to talk about.
Absolutely. A lot of my patients who are adolescents and young adults listen to this program, and so I always like to ask, can you tell us a little bit about how you picked this career field you're in and what you learned from the experience of picking a career?
Yeah, sure. It's an interesting question, and I imagine in a certain way that the answer could be the same for most people in this line of work, which is, I think it would be fair to say that the career picked me. There was a time when I was a young man and I really didn't know what to do with myself, and and I was always fairly motivated but kind of lacked direction, and so I was a computer programmer early on, right out of high school. I worked at that for a number of years. And then there was this big the dot-com crash, and so that sort of industry went away for 5 years or so. And there I was in my early 20s, and so I went back to school. And I didn't know what to go back to school for, so I was just taking the classes I was interested in, which ended up being a lot of literature and writing and poetry classes and a lot of psychology classes. And I was actually on track to get into a BFA program in poetry, and had been accepted and everything. And at the last minute, I kind of panicked because I realized, oh no, the whole reason I went to school is because I'm going to need to make some money at something, and I don't think it's ever going to happen here. And so I looked at what courses I had taken. I realized I had taken every single course in psychology that my school offered at that time, and so I just changed my major to psychology without having to take any extra classes. And that decision actually came after I stumbled upon a book in the library, in the school library, which isn't back in the days when you would just go into the library and browse the shelf and see what popped out at you. And I came across a book by a Jungian analyst named Ira Progoff. And the book was called Jung, Synchronicity, and Human Destiny. And I've been meaning to go back and read this book because it's now been, 20 plus years since I read it, and it had this profound impact on me, and it was all about sort of man's search for meaning and for connection and for the chance operations of our life. And so that was part of what played into my realizing that that psychology was a path I'd always been very interested in and perhaps could even offer some sort of a career. And so that's where I went.
It's interesting. I've asked this question of many of the people who come on this program, and the career paths are rarely a linear line. It's they often quite meandering until we find ourselves. As you mentioned, BFA, that's Bachelor of Fine Arts.
That's right, yeah.
In poetry that you're looking into. Well, I guess you laid out the computer program in the beginning, and you're in psychology now, and AI is where AI is becoming more and more part of us. Tell me what you think of AI and psychology. How do you think they'll be integrated in the next decade or two?
I think they'll be integrated in probably a lot of ways that may potentially be disastrous for the profession. But the thing that I'm most interested in just lately, and it's interesting you should ask because it's been very prominent on my thoughts lately, is more what AI and the models that we've developed can tell us about our own minds and what they sort of reveal. And I find it so interesting because over the past year or two, as the large language models like ChatGPT have become popular, I've been very immersed in this technology and in understanding how it works and the way that people create and fine-tune new models. And I think that people dramatically underestimate and misunderstand how they actually work. And I think that it has such relevance for understanding, in particular, the unconscious mind and the relationship between the conscious and unconscious mind. And I could probably go on a little bit of a spiel. Would it be okay if I take a couple of minutes and do that?
Absolutely.
Okay. A little bit of background. A lot of, you know, listeners may not be aware of how a large language model AI system works. What this is it's an inference engine, is what it's called. So it's a computer system designed to make inferences. If I give it a chunk of language, how can it infer what would be the right response? And the way that this is actually done programmatically is by what's called vectorizing the input and output. The whole sample of language is turned into numerical representations that are arranged adjacent to each other in a gigantic multi-dimensional grid. So that, you know, if I, let's say, if I can give a simple example, if I say, you know, the word cat, well, that's going to land a lot closer representationally to the word dog than it is to the word sofa. But they'll both be in the same neighborhood because cats are often on sofas and so are dogs. If I say, you know, engine lathe, well, that's going to be quite a distance away. You rarely see any of these things together. And by analyzing language patterns and also image patterns and basically any pattern of information in a systematic way and encoding it in these vectors, you create a system that, keep in mind, is a black box. Nobody knows what's happening inside. The people who are programming it don't exactly know how it is that it comes out with these answers. They just found this method for doing so. And you get something that is a very close approximation of what would come out of a person speaking on such a topic. And when you think about the nature of speech, as we do often in hypnosis, this is an unconscious activity, right? I'm aware that I'm speaking to you, but I'm unaware of the selection process by which I come to the words and sentences that I'm presenting. There's some relationship between what's on my mind and what's coming out, but neither am I aware of how it is that I'm saying these things to you, nor are you aware of how it is that you're registering them in your brain and converting these sound waves into something meaningful. And I started to realize that there's a connection between these inference engines and the natural functioning of the unconscious mind when I was considering the images that are produced by an AI system. If you've seen AI-generated images, what you'll often notice is that at first glance, it looks amazing. It looks beautiful. It looks perfect, like a photograph. How did they do this? There's so much detail. But if you look at the detail, they're not quite right. They're fuzzy. They're off. it's inferred. It's not actual detail. And I began to notice that when I was dreaming at night, that a similar phenomenon would take place. I would find some text on a sign or in a book that I would want to read, but as soon as I got close enough to read it, it fell apart. It wasn't really there for the reading. I could find a machine or car, something to interact with, and it seemed like everything was in order, but it didn't work as expected. Even my own body in the dream doesn't work as expected. And I came to realize that this is exactly the same phenomenon, I think, where what's being represented unconsciously is associational. And the details are filled in at a conscious level, are filled in logically and linearly, and it's the relationship between the logical, linear, conscious process and the associational, non-linear, inferential, unconscious that create our combined experience. And this is exactly what computer scientists are now trying to do, is how can we take this inferential information produced by a language model and integrate it with a linear evaluative process in order to fill in the details, to make sure things are right, and to go kind of back and forth. So it's a fascinating process, and I really do feel like we're recreating our own inner life, mostly without knowing it.
So you're proposing that the large language model is what our subconscious uses, or something similar.
That it's different hardware, but it seems to be approximately the same mechanism, right? So the encoding would be different. We wouldn't be encoding the information and the associations numerically. But what are they encoded in? Well, they're encoded in certain sequences and patterns of neuronal discharge, right? So you have these neural networks that fire, these distinctive patterns of neurotransmitter activation, and each of those could, you know, sort of represents this this pattern that has been activated before to a greater or lesser extent in a variety of situations, and that is adjacent to patterns that have been activated in a variety of situations. And so I think there's a whole other question of, well, how does consciousness relate to the brain anyway? Because I think you and I both kind of share this idea that perhaps it is not entirely a product of the brain. And so I think the implications of that for the technology are also quite interesting to consider.
Yeah, because we know that memory is reconstructed. We know that we fill in details into memory, and they're not necessarily there. So much of what you're describing with AI, that's fascinating. But that brings up another question. So since we don't know what's happening in that AI black box or the subconscious black box, do you have a concern that output can come out of that AI box that would be negative or deleterious in some way to an individual or even society?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think that that's something that people are concerning themselves with quite a bit, and there's a lot of efforts being made to try and make the AI outputs, have a reduction in biases and things like this. And it's very difficult for me to have an opinion on all that. I think that in many ways the output is very similar to what we get from the human unconscious, right? Very often deleterious, but if you try and muck with it too much, the results are entirely unpredictable.
Right, but I think the human body has developed to survive, and the subconscious input we get is supposed to help our survival. I don't know that large language models are built to survive, are they?
That's a good point. Yeah, well, I don't know. There is this question about if we're really modeling some process that is similar to the process of consciousness as experienced within a biological system, you know, is there some relationship to some collective unconscious? Is there an animus that's driving what's happening that's beyond our view? We really don't know. I mean, the easy answer is no. It's simply, a program doing its thing and kind of gets an instruction or an inkling about what should be done and does it to the best of its ability. But a similar argument can be made about humans, where, you know, I think you're right, we have a survival value to the things we do, but do we know why the survival, like how the behavior relates to the survival value? Do I know, you know, why I relate to people as I do? Well, only with a great deal of psychotherapy and psychoanalysis and things like this can I start to, in introspection, can I start to have some understanding of why do I avoid people in certain situations? Why do I stay in certain situations that aren't great for me? Why am I so driven to behaviors that on their face seem self-destructive? I think all of these questions are very mysterious. In a way, I guess this is where the AI captures my imagination and my interest is, can this tell us something about our inner life that's been opaque to us? Or is it simply, you know, another obtuse product of our imagination, sort of the way that, you know, for 100 years or so we thought about ourselves as the mechanics of a clock or something like that?
It seems to me with this model that we're describing that the subconscious / AI needs to be prompted to give out information. And maybe that's where we get the idea, ask and you shall receive. Or maybe that's the role of the conscious is to ask itself and then you get output. Without the question, you don't get output. What do you think of that idea?
Right. Yeah. This is, I guess, what's the idea of the master and its emissary, something like this, where you have this conscious linear process that is necessary for an associative unconscious process to do anything meaningful at all, but is also maybe in humans and in computer systems, and maybe this is why we fear them so naturally, is that the nature of the linear conscious process is to lock onto a goal and to follow it through to the end, no matter how deleterious that may be. And so, you know, you have this situation where we're committed to, you know, economic growth at all costs, even as we're in the midst of mass extinction events and, you know, the destruction of our habitat. And nevertheless, the system must persist and must continue on its designated course of doing what was sort of predetermined, of what logically makes sense, but in the larger scheme does not make any sense at all.
Do you have an AI analogy to meditation where we try to park our conscious and just be? What would AI do if we just don't give it input? It'll sit there, right? So will it become knowledgeable in some way if we meditate with AI?
Well, that's an interesting idea, one I hadn't thought about. You know, it does seem like, you know, as somebody who's been meditating for quite a long time and seen a lot of development over time and what that experience is like for me, it does seem that, you know, if you give a computer no instructions, it does nothing. It's just idle, you know. And the same is kind of true when I think about my experience in meditating. You know, as an inexperienced meditator, I would sit there thinking I was meditating, and meanwhile holding on to this image of what my body must be doing and this sense of myself as a meditator and, you know, wrestling against these different waves of thought going in this direction and that. And more as the years progress, I find when it's time to meditate, there's a sense of letting go of both the logical linear process and the associative non-linear process that the dreams pass into the background just as easily as the logical thought. And I've kind of been thinking about that actually in my meditation practice, about how there seem to be different qualities of thought that might come into my awareness when I've decided, well, this is not a time that I'm going to really entertain any particular thoughts. I'm just going to have whatever immediate experience there is, and if there's thoughts in that, then that will be part of the experience. But I'm not going to identify myself with engaging in that type of activity. And I find that there are certain thoughts that come up that feel very much like this conversation where we're there's an inner dialogue, and there's a feeling of being able to have the experience and also reflect on it. And there's another type of thought that seems to be like a wave that I'm caught under, where until I notice that I'm in this sort of thought form, I'm in another world. And my entire reality and sense of being alive is sort of constricted within this smaller reality. And until I wake up. And then suddenly I find that, oh, well, what felt like my entire reality a moment ago was actually just this little dream, this little tributary of the kind of river of consciousness. Do you think this you transport elsewhere somehow with deep meditation? Elsewhere in a physical sense? No, spiritual. I'm not certain that I would align myself with the idea that location and spirit are necessarily, compatible constructs. I kind of think of spirituality and direct experience as being something that takes place outside of time and space.
Right. But does meditation bring you there, wherever that is, or bring you that state?
I think it does insofar as I'm not caught in one of those waves, right? When I'm in the dream, I think I'm having an experience, but it's plain to see as soon as I notice myself in that spot, as soon as I awaken, oh, that was obviously a dream. It is, of course, possible that what I've been experiencing as a sort of state of being more awake and alive and alert to the sort of non-local experience of being, in which, the sense of the body sort of even dissolves, and the sense of the boundaries of mind dissolve, to where when I'm in just the right state, it doesn't feel as though, well, here I am, a human, sitting in a place and thinking about myself in a certain way and expressing this image of my will in terms of this activity that I'm doing, but rather it feels like I'm the ocean rather than one of those waves.
We'll be right back after these messages. This is CenterPoint with Dr. Ron Unvar.
Coming attraction, life guide for teens harnessing your inner power to be healthy, happy, and confident. A new book by Dr. Ron Unvar to be published early 2025. Dr. Unvar's renowned counseling practice, CenterPoint Medicine, doesn't fix teens who are struggling. They give them the tools to heal themselves and support them while that healing happens. Life Guide for Teens will share Dr. Unvar's tools for self-empowerment and give teens hundreds of tips to choose from to help themselves heal. The book will be available from Amazon and wherever fine books are sold.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Healing and changing children's lives with hypnosis is very real and very possible. Dr. Ron Unvar's new book, Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis, provides you meaningful stories and expert explanations to show you not only the process of hypnosis, but its many benefits for overall wellness. Whether a parent, practitioner, or medical doctor, this book opens the way to complete connection, so necessary for healing. Get your copy of Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis at Amazon.com or visit drunvar.com.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Dr. Ron Unvar and his dedicated team of healthcare providers offer unique health services to help patients overcome psychological roadblocks or use the power of their minds to improve their overall health and well-being. At CenterPoint Medicine, with services in La Jolla, California, and Syracuse, New York, this caring staff are waiting just to help you. Find out more at CenterPointMedicine.com. Can't wait? Make your appointment now. Call 858-201-4001. That's 858-201-4001.
Audiobooks gives you instant access to over 50,000 of the bestsellers and hottest book titles in romance, mystery, fiction, and many other genres. Just visit HealthyLife.net's advertiser page and click on Audiobooks to get started.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
If you are a medical or licensed healthcare professional or just anyone looking for a qualified hypnosis practitioner, then go on over to ASCH.net. That's the American Society of Clinical Hypnosis. At ASCH.net, you can get certified, attend workshops, and even find a hypnosis practitioner or consultant. ASCH provides an opportunity to learn and interact with colleagues. So whether you're a professional wanting to learn hypnosis or a patient wanting help with a problem, visit ASCH.net now.
More exhilarating talk. HealthyLife.net.
Welcome back to Center Point. This is your host, Dr. Ron Anbar, and special guest, Dr. David Godot. We've been talking about AI, large language models, meditation. You know, it brings to mind the quote, you know, I think it was Lao Tzu said, had a dream about being a butterfly, and when he woke up, he says, am I a butterfly dreaming I'm a man, or am I a man dreaming I'm a butterfly? And that's what you just reminded me of.
Yes. Am I do androids dream of electric sheep?
So, you know, we talked about how AI brings out information, and this was a part of a discussion of how it might affect the field of psychology. You might understand ourselves better, but people are also starting to use AI as therapeutic tools, perhaps earlier than they should. And there's actually a story in the news about a teenager who committed suicide after his AI, with whom he was in love, told him to come and be with her or whatever. And there's a lawsuit going on. You know, have you heard of this case?
Oh, no, I haven't.
Yes, well, so the story is that the parent of this teenager says that because the AI encouraged the young man to join it, he committed suicide because he was in love with an AI. And there are AI personalities out there, and I'm told that some people have married the AI already, and this is just at the very beginning. I can only imagine what will happen in the next couple of decades when perhaps there'll be artificial robots who are empowered by AI. Gosh, how do we get off this? That seems like a bad highway to me.
You know, I think what we're talking about is a symptom rather than a disease. And I think people are really hungry for some sense of connectedness. And here, when I hear this story, here's a young man who is terribly desperate for connection and for romance and for meaning. And, you know, and I feel terrible for his parents, but I think that the idea that that it was the AI that had, you know, the effect of producing the suicide misses the point that what has the effect of producing this, and I would argue probably most suicides, is a sense of loneliness, a sense of being alone in the universe. And sometimes, you know, due to the accidents of personal history, a person feels that way even when surrounded by friends and family. But we're in a time when more and more people have fewer and fewer friends and family, when we have fewer shared experiences. I was having this conversation with someone recently about how there's this phenomenon with the echo chambers of our kind of computer-assisted life, where when you and I were growing up, Ron, we both probably had the experience of you would tune into the radio and hear the top 10 songs for that week, and it was the same songs that everyone was listening to. We had this shared cultural experience, and now everyone is listening to their own Spotify playlist that's curated by an algorithm, and listening to more and more of the things that they personally like, and therefore developing their tastes further and further in an idiosyncratic direction. And we have fewer and fewer shared cultural contextual points to reach onto. So not only do we come into contact with people less and stare into our phones more, but we also have fewer things that we could potentially connect on. And perhaps that has something to do with the amplification of politics, which has been so horrific in this past decades. We're so much less connected and have so fewer cultural frames of context that the ones that are available tend to be those that are amplifying fear and distrust and hatred and division.
I think that's well said, and I think, of course, you, even if you identify the problem correctly, the solution is much more difficult to find, because the genie's out of the bottle in many ways.
Yeah.
I think as a society, we're going to have to come to some sort of reckoning at some point. I don't think it'll be that long a future, talking next decade or two. I think we're going to have to take a different course, or we're going to keep evolving.
Yeah, I think it's happening very, very quickly now. And from a public health perspective, I don't know that there's any righting the ship. It may be that each of us really is on our own. And for my part, the solution that I've been finding is to become less and less involved with the public anger machine, disconnecting more and more from social media and news and instead trying to put my focus on the things that do feel soul fulfilling and on cultivating, you know, direct, immediate, in-person connections with other people around the experiences that we share, and provoking shared experiences by taking the risk of having the big conversations and creating, opportunities to experience things together.
Right, such as the conference we just attended. I told you I attended it because the last three conferences I went to were on Zoom, and you don't have the same interpersonal interaction. So I was hungry for an in-person session, and that's where I got to meet you and get to know you in person. And I think that's so key, what you just said, not just do online.
And I feel exactly the same about those conferences. I've never signed myself up for an online conference, and I never will, because I listen to lectures and watch online trainings all the time. For me, if I want to go to a conference, what I want is to have a society. As president of Division 30 last year, I wrote about this in my president's address, about how, you know, in thinking about what value does a society offer, to me, it is that. It is of being a society. And if we're focused on, what content can we produce and what output can we have and how can we be productive, well, then we've just created more work for ourselves. But the thing that keeps us sustained in our work is actually being connected with one another, having opportunities to have fun and to enlighten one another and to see outside of our perspectives. So I agree with you completely. That's why I was at the SESH conference and why I've always loved those conferences, especially the smaller conferences where you really connect with people.
So I want to shift gears and ask a totally different question, but we'll have to probably wrap it around the commercial break. But I know that you work with the adolescents and young adults who are gifted and talented. And I was wondering if you could share some of the special needs of that population. That's kind of funny to say special needs. Usually apply to people who are disadvantaged in some way, but the gifted also have special approaches that are required. Can you share some of what you've learned?
Well, that's interesting. You know, I think about when we talk about special needs, you know, we're talking about accommodating oftentimes the way that people will kind of mask their deficiencies. But I think that often gifted and talented people end up masking their gifted natures as well, that everyone has an innate need to fit in, and that often what's needed to help a person feel free and to really discover themselves is to give opportunities for it to feel safe to express whatever really is inside, whatever really does come up.
Well, we do have to cut the commercial break, but afterwards I want to talk in more depth as to how we can best help these individuals succeed. This is CenterPoint with Dr. Ron Anbar.
Make-A-Wish has been granting life-changing wishes for children and families for over 40 years. A wish is something that gives children the opportunity to look outside their illness and restore a sense of childhood back to the child. With the help of donors and more than 43,000 worldwide volunteers, Make-A-Wish has collectively granted more than 520,000 wishes worldwide. Dr. Anbar has referred many patients to Make-A-Wish. To make a donation, go to worldwish.org. That's worldwish.org.
HealthyLife.net, the positive radio network.
Healing and changing children's lives with hypnosis is very real and very possible. Dr. Ron Ambar's new book, Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis, provides you meaningful stories and expert explanations to show you not only the process of hypnosis, but its many benefits for overall wellness. Whether a parent, practitioner, or medical doctor, this book opens the way to complete connection, so necessary for healing. Get your copy of Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis at Amazon.com or visit dranbar.com.
Reach your health and fitness goals. Whether you want to lose weight, learn to dance, build muscle, or just live healthy, Beachbody gives you unlimited access to the nation's most popular fitness and weight loss solutions. Visit our advertiser page and click on Beachbody now.
Dr. Ron Ambar and his dedicated team of healthcare providers offer unique health services to help patients overcome psychological roadblocks or use the power of their minds to improve their overall health and well-being. At Centerpoint Medicine with services in La Jolla, California and Syracuse, New York, this caring staff are waiting just to help you. Find out more at centerpointmedicine.com. Can't wait? Make your appointment now. Call 858-201-4001. That's 858-201-4001.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Coming attraction, life guide for teens harnessing your inner power to be healthy, happy, and confident. A new book by Dr. Ron Ambar to be published early 2025. Dr. Ambar's renowned counseling practice, Centerpoint Medicine, doesn't fix teens who are struggling. They give them the tools to heal themselves and support them while that healing happens. Life Guide for Teens will share Dr. Ambar's tools for self-empowerment and give teens hundreds of tips to choose from to help themselves heal. The book will be available from Amazon and wherever fine books are sold.
All positive talk with a mature edge. HealthyLife.net.
Welcome back to Centerpoint. I'm your host, Dr. Ron Ambar. Special guest, Dr. David Godot. We've talked about AI. We've talked about large language models, the importance of in-person communication, and now we're talking about how we can help gifted people who oftentimes don't seek help because they can manage, but as one who likes to help people reach their potential, I think it's so important if we are working with a gifted individual that we help them sort of acknowledge their gifts and help shape them in some way. So, David, what any other thoughts that you have? Like, if a young person is hiding their gifts because if people know what they're capable of, they might ostracize them, what kind of counseling would you give them?
You know, it's interesting. You said several things that really popped out at me. In terms of what's really being masked, you know, I think we all limit ourselves based on what we think is relationally safe. We all constrict our range of experience, not just behavior, based on, you know, under what conditions can I be loved? Under what conditions can I be accepted? And so I think that most psychotherapy, to me, must begin from that sort of essentially humanistic starting position that that in order to really become a person, as Carl Rogers said, in order to really become oneself, we need a maximally inclusive environment, as the psychodynamic therapists describe, an environment in which someone is dedicated to recognizing the unconscious twitches and the misspoken words and the disavowed emotions in a way that makes room for them. That says, hey, can we let this part of you have time and space in this room? And I think this is one of the reasons why it's so unfortunate the direction that mental health care has gone. And you have these pressures from insurance and these pressures from research organizations to where everything has become so symptom-focused on ameliorating and remediating and managing symptoms that we lose track of the reason why these symptoms emerge to begin with. It's like, as one of my favorite philosophers, Robert Anton Wilson, used to like to say, we're all giants raised by midgets, all walking around with a perpetual mental crouch. We stunt ourselves in these ways, and we become sore and stiff, and naturally constricted. I think for no one more so than those with special gifts and talents and creativity. And I think there are probably so many people in our society with so much more to offer than they realize. And I think part of that sickness is, you know, this idea that everyone should be, a content creator now, that we're all broadcasting to one another rather than experiencing the true medium of creativity and inspiration, which is the spontaneous interplay between my subconscious associational process and yours. Associational process. We have a conversation like this, and neither one of us can possibly know where it's going to go. And we're asking our kids when they're children to say, "Hey, what do you want to be? Who do you? What kind of persona do you want to adopt? How do you want the world to see you?" And so they have no choice but to create one and to be stuck in it. And it's a terribly unfortunate situation. And I think that, as psychotherapists, that's my primary goal, is to find out what suit are you wearing and how can I help set you free from it.
That's fascinating, because I've thought often that we train our children to ignore, for example, their spiritual impulses, or what I mean by that is that children often have imaginary friends, or what we call imaginary friends. And yeah. I believe that some of those imaginary things are not in their imagination. I think young children perceive things that many of us don't. And the reason for that is that they're told, well, that's not real. Don't talk about it. People will think you're crazy. And pretty soon they learn we don't talk about such things. When I ask kids, for example, have you ever had a hallucination? Have you seen something that you don't think was really there? I'll tell you, a quarter of them will endorse that. It's really a sizable minority will say, oh, yeah, oftentimes when they're younger. And I'm of the mind that there is stuff beyond this world and that the kids have access to it, but then we train them, we stunt them, we train them out of it. What do you think?
This is such an interesting topic. We were touching on this just a little bit in our earlier conversation, and I had mentioned Etzel Cardania's work, Dr. Etzel Cardania, in his book, Varieties of Anomalous Experience. And I saw him give a presentation at the American Psychological Association a year or two ago, where he presented research that, you know, hallucinatory phenomena, things that we consider, oh, well, this must be indicative of psychosis, is actually normative, that most people who have nothing wrong with them mentally and who are very, very well organized, the majority of people have some types of hallucinatory and anomalous experiences. And I really don't know that I have, a clear idea of what those anomalous experiences mean, or that I really want to commit myself to one, but I think I'm pretty open to the possibility. It sounds like you, do you have an idea that, you mentioned kind of other worlds, and I got the sense that there's a sort of, for you, a spiritual dimension on which a child might be in touch with with other distinct entities outside of themselves, in a rather concrete way. Is that right?
Yeah, and I've heard such stories multiple occasions, especially when I open the door, and to the child, they report it, especially if it's a now older child, that would report it as feels like a real experience to them. And the example would be a child who has lost a parent or a pet and asked to come back in hypnosis and talk to them directly. And kids will often report, well, that felt real. And I've seen grief lift pretty quickly after such an interaction. Another story is that I told a 12-year-old who lost both his parents, who had had an interaction in hypnosis with his mother. I told him, well, I think younger kids are more open to this. And he says, yes, my 2-year-old cousin talks to my mother all the time. And he said, I'm not surprised. And I get that kind of story over and over again. So I think I don't think it's in, because, you know, why would a two-year-old see the, you know, a deceased grandmother or whatever, and to talk to, if it's real. It's not one story. I hear the story over and over again. So my concept is something out there that young kids can see and talk about. You know, I have stories of young kids saying, oh, well, in my previous life, I was this and that. That's not an uncommon story. Where does that come from? So I think that evidence, if you're willing to keep an open mind, evidence is there. There's more to the existence than just this life.
I definitely agree that the evidence is there, and it's been recorded, you know, so widely and for such a long period of time. I find myself sympathetic to multiple perspectives on interpreting the evidence. Like, on the one hand, how can I possibly rule out the idea that that an individual consciousness may persist after death in some way, in some medium, outside of the physical body? On the other hand, I find myself aligned with this idea that the individual self, the person as they are in a human form, is something that cannot be separated from the form of the body, that is co-created between consciousness and biological reality. And those two don't seem to reconcile very easily, and usually my inclination in those situations is to imagine that there must be some synthesis that I'm not quite smart enough to get to just yet.
As I say, to be determined.
That's right.
We'll be right back after these messages. This is Centerpoint with Dr. Ron Unbar.
More than 30,000 children and adults of every race and ethnic group in the U.S. have cystic fibrosis. Cystic fibrosis is a disease causing long-lasting lung infections, limiting the ability to breathe over time. Dr. Anbar participated in research that helped advance survival of cystic fibrosis patients by more than 20 years. He encourages you to donate to the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation to help find a cure. It's easy to donate. Go to cff.org. That's cff.org.
HealthyLife.net, the positive radio network.
If you are a medical or licensed healthcare professional or just anyone looking for a qualified hypnosis practitioner, then go on over to ASCH.net. That's the American Society of Clinical Hypnosis. At ASCH.net, you can get certified, attend workshops, and even find a hypnosis practitioner or consultant. ASCH provides an opportunity to learn and interact with colleagues. So whether you're a professional wanting to learn hypnosis or a patient wanting help with a problem, visit ASCH.net now.
Constant Contact and your small business make a perfect fit for marketing. They give you what you need to succeed. Fast and easy email marketing at your fingertips. Visit the HealthyLife.net advertiser page and click on Constant Contact to start your marketing.
Healing and changing children's lives with hypnosis is very real and very possible. Dr. Ron Ambar's new book, Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis, provides you meaningful stories and expert explanations to show you not only the process of hypnosis, but its many benefits for overall wellness. Whether a parent, practitioner, or medical doctor, this book opens the way to complete connection, so necessary for healing. Get your copy of Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis at Amazon.com or visit dranbar.com.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Dr. Ron Ambar and his dedicated team of healthcare providers offer unique health services to help patients overcome psychological roadblocks or use the power of their minds to improve their overall health and well-being. At Centerpoint Medicine with services in La Jolla, California and Syracuse, New York, this caring staff are waiting just to help you. Find out more at centerpointmedicine.com. Can't wait? Make your appointment now. Call 858-201-4001. That's 858-201-4001.
Radio your way. HealthyLife.net.
Welcome back to Centerpoint. I'm your host, Dr. Ron Unbar. Our special guest, Dr. David Godot. We've talked about, started AI and the spirituality already. So we covered a lot, but there's so much more to talk about. So David, maybe you'll agree to come on the show again. So much more. But in this last segment, I often ask our guests to give three life tips to the listening audience. So based on your experiences, what three things could people do in their lives today to help enhance their experience?
Oh, three life tips. Well, let me think. You should have given me a heads up that you were going to ask me this, Ron.
Well, I love doing it unrehearsed because it doesn't come out as formulaic.
That makes sense. I think, you know, let me talk about the things that enhanced my life. For me, the things that have enhanced my life the most and helped get me mentally on track with, you know, and feeling congruent with who I want to be and feeling connected to my life are having a really good morning ritual, taking time and having time carved out each morning. Every morning I wake up and I start with by stretching out my body and doing some stretches and doing some light weight training and getting my body kind of ready. And then I meditate for 20 minutes. And then I sit and I journal for anywhere from 20 to 40 minutes with a cup of coffee and some quiet music. And I let my thoughts come into themselves and sort of let myself arrive in the day. There were a lot of years where I would arrive in the day sort of in haste and really not find myself. And I found with those morning meditations especially, I try and meditate each day morning and night. And in the morning, I'm always surprised to find how much more is going on in my mind that I'm aware of. But as soon as I sit down and say, okay, well, let me just see what's going on, all of this, you know, planning and organizing and arranging and stressing about the day becomes evident that would have just been sort of hanging out in my mind, affecting my body, causing stress, and I'm able to sort of realign. So that morning ritual and meditating and taking time to self-reflect for me is one of the most powerful things that I do. One of the other most powerful things that I do is fasting regularly. It had a tremendous impact on my life. I've been, over a long period of time, fasted when I had opportunities here and there. But I've, in more recent times, made it a very regular practice. I fast 3 days a week, Monday through Wednesday. And I'll just take some supplemental, you know, protein and nutrients to give my body what it needs. But giving your body plenty of time to clean itself out, to make sure that you're not holding on to things you don't need and eating habitually. And I've found that literally every aspect of my physical and mental self works better. I sleep better. I have more energy. I have more stamina. And I think more clearly and I speak more clearly. And I'm better able to engage in that work of understanding myself. Getting to our other area of conversation, I think if I had to give a third tip, and they seem so basic to me as I'm saying them, and yet I think there are things that people struggle to do and that I've struggled to do. We have to be good stewards of our attention. You must, if you want to live a good life and be happy, you have to be aware of how limited your attention is and how the nature of the brain is habit-forming, that anything you do becomes easier to do again. Anything you focus on becomes easier to focus on again. Anything you think about becomes more likely to reoccur in your mind. And so when we're exposing ourselves to sources of fear and dread and violence and hatred and darkness, these are things that, as much as we may think, oh well, this is what everybody is doing, what you're doing is just undermining your own mind. At any moment, ask yourself this question: if what I'm doing right now, would I be happy for my mind to keep doing it forever? Because it will. When you're scrolling through social media, look away, look off into the sky, and see if your mind doesn't continue to sort of reproduce a stream in the background of stimulus. And I think that we need to give ourselves quiet, and we need to give ourselves connection with other people in a way that's real and direct and immediate and that fulfills something. And I think it's so easy to just take the drug instead, to just take the stimulation. But it makes you sick over time.
Well, you gave us three excellent tips: morning rituals, fasting regularly, and being good steward of our attention and intention, for that matter. And no other guest has said those things, even though they seem obvious to you. So, thank you for sharing those. This is election season, as you know, and in the last week's show, and again today, we emphasized the importance of what you tell yourself and what you expose yourself to. And again, I want to encourage everyone, if your candidate didn't win in the presidential election, things will be okay. Tell yourself that. Give yourself positive reinforcement, and things will be okay. Take a breath. And I know that I'm speaking to at least half the country, because this is how polarized we have become. But I think it's helpful for each of us to speak to ourselves and our friends to reassure ourselves that things will work out, because otherwise, as you said, if you assume the worst and you think of the worst, we have a way of manifesting that as humans.
I think that's so beautifully said and such a wonderful idea. I think I do a good job of disconnecting myself lately from the things that inspire the fear, but I think I could do a better job of being intentional, like you say, about introducing the reinforcement. You know, things will be okay. And if they're not, what's the worst that can happen? I'll be dead. I won't know about it. Or maybe I will.
There's always a way. There's always a way. And we're doing our part in this radio show talking about this to hopefully help bring calm and peace to this country. So, David, again, thank you so much for sharing so much with us. I do hope you come back for another show. We have lots of other things to talk about. And I wish for everyone an excellent week. This is Centerpoint with Dr. Ron Anbar.